Good evening. So nice to be back in our nation's capital. In his immortal play, A Man for All Seasons, Robert Bolt provides a fictional account of an argument between Sir Thomas More, who served as Chancellor of England and would later become the patron saint of lawyers and judges, and his son-in-law, William Roper. The argument is about the demands of fidelity to both law and morality. In the course of the argument, More pleads, "The law, Roper, the law. I know what's legal, not what's right. And I'll stick to what's legal." Roper then makes two provocative charges against More. First, Roper asserts to More, "Then you set man's law above God's." More responds in the negative, "No, far below. But let me draw your attention to a fact. I'm not God. The currents and eddies of right and wrong, which you find such plain sailing, I can't navigate. I'm no voyager. But in the thickets of the law, oh, there I'm a forester. I doubt if there's a man alive who could follow me there, thank God." Later, Roper charges, "So now you give the devil benefit of law." To that charge, More responds in the affirmative and asks a question of Roper. "Yes, what would you do? Cut a great road through the law to get after the devil?" Roper then falls into the trap when he answers, "I'd cut down every law in England to do that." More then offers the most memorable lines of the entire play. "Oh, and when the last law was down and the devil turned round on you, where would you hide, Roper? The laws all being flat. This country's planted thick with laws from coast to coast. Man's laws, not God's. And if you cut them down, and you're just the man to do it, do you really think you could stand upright in the winds that would blow then? Yes, I'd give the devil benefit of law for my own safety's sake." Robert Bolt's portrait of St. Thomas More offers lawyers and judges the right role model. I have been asked to reflect tonight on my personal experiences, both formerly as a state attorney general and as a nominee for a federal judgeship, who was embroiled in controversies about the potential conflict of moral and legal duties. The stakes of those controversies, thankfully, were not nearly as high as those that led to the execution of St. Thomas More. But they were at least high drama in the contemporary arena of American law and politics. In each instance, the law offered me the right path to follow. My first experience came in June 2003, 2 months after the president, then George W. Bush, nominated me to serve as a United States Circuit Judge. That nomination was controversial for several reasons. Among them, my public statement as a politician that Roe versus Wade was, quote, "the worst abomination of constitutional law in our history." That's a quote. My defense as Attorney General of Alabama of a law that made sodomy a crime. And even my decision as a parent to plan a family vacation at Disney World so as not to coincide with the Gay Day festivities at the park. During my confirmation hearing, a few members of the Senate Judiciary Committee raised questions about my, quote, "deeply held beliefs," and whether I was, quote, "asserting an agenda of my own, a religious belief of my own, inconsistent with separation of church and state." When the committee chairman, Senator Hatch, responded to those statements by asking about my Catholic faith, and then asserting that in every case he could see, I had followed the law regardless of my religious beliefs, two other senators objected to Chairman Hatch's reference to my religion. Later that summer, an interest group sponsored political advertisements that described opponents of my confirmation to the federal bench as engaged in discrimination against me based on my Catholic faith. that advertisement portrayed a sign that read, "Catholics need not apply," hanging on a door to a federal courthouse. That advertisement created a furor in the Senate and a lively debate in national newspapers and magazines. My second experience came at the end of that same summer, when Roy Moore, who was then the Chief Justice of Alabama, refused to obey an injunction of a federal district court that required the removal of a monument of the Ten Commandments from the rotunda of the Alabama Judicial Building. As Attorney General, I publicly disagreed with Moore and assisted the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of Alabama in ensuring compliance with the injunction. After the Alabama Judicial Inquiry Commission then filed charges of misconduct against Moore, I personally prosecuted the charges in the Alabama Court of the Judiciary, which unanimously granted my request to remove Moore from his judicial office. Throughout these experiences about the potential conflict of legal and moral duties, my perspective has been that I should follow the example of St. Thomas More. My Catholic faith is the foundation of my worldview, and my judicial duty is governed from beginning to end by the law. Faith properly informs the religious lawyer or judge, and morality is not in tension with fidelity to the law. I will first address my perspective about the controversy that affected my judicial nomination, the role of religion in judging. Religious faith properly informs me as a judge and my fidelity to my judicial duty in at least four ways: in my understanding of my oath of office, in my moral duty to obey lawful authority, and in my responsibility to work both diligently and honestly. Each of these ways is motivational. That is, each concerns the judge's duty to perform his work well. None involves using religious doctrine to decide a case in conflict with the law. The most fundamental way that faith properly matters to me as a judge is in my understanding of my judicial oath of office. The framers required in Article 6 of the Constitution that the officers of our government, including judges, quote, be bound by oath or affirmation to support the Constitution. In the next part of that clause, they provided that no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. The framers thought that the particular religious beliefs of the judge should not matter, but that it was crucial for the judge to have his conscience, as informed by those beliefs, bound by the Constitution. Now, many of the states had a different rule. Delaware, for example, in Article 22 of its Constitution of 1776, required officers to profess faith in God the Father and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, and in the Holy Ghost, one God, blessed forevermore, and to acknowledge the holy scriptures of the Old and New Testament to be given by divine inspiration. Vermont, in Chapter 2, Section 9 of its Constitution of 1777, required legislators to declare, "I do believe in one God, the creator and governor of the universe, the rewarder of the good and punisher of the wicked, and I do acknowledge the scriptures of the Old and New Testament to be given by divine inspiration, and own and profess the Protestant religion." I'm especially grateful that last line of the Vermont Constitution did not become part of the federal Constitution. You know, a lot's changed in Vermont. During the ratification process, some Americans objected to the ban of religious tests, as many Protestants feared the election or appointment of Catholics to federal office. James Arundel, a delegate to the North Carolina ratifying convention, provided my favorite rejoinder to these objections when he rose to defend the ban on religious tests on July 30, 1787. His words were especially memorable for Catholics. Arundel said, "I met by accident with a pamphlet this morning in which the author states as a very serious danger that the Pope of Rome might be elected president. I confess this never struck me before, and if the author had read all the qualifications of a president, perhaps his fears might have been quieted. No man but a native and who has resided 14 years in America can be chosen president. I know not all the qualifications for a pope, but I believe he must be taken from the College of Cardinals, and probably there are many previous steps necessary before he arrives at this dignity. A native of America must have very singular good fortune, who, after residing 14 years in his own country, should go to Europe, enter into Romish orders, obtain the promotion of cardinal, afterwards that of pope, and at length be so much in the confidence of his own country to be elected president. It would be still more extraordinary if he should give up his popedom for our presidency. Sir, it is impossible to treat such idle fears with any degree of gravity. The framers' general understanding was that prescribing religious tests did not necessarily remove the religious significance of the general oath. James Madison, the father of the Constitution, for example, explained in a letter to Edmund Pendleton in 1787 that an oath should make a religious test unnecessary. Madison wrote, "Is not a religious test, as far as it is necessary or would operate, involved in the oath itself? If the person swearing believes in the supreme being who is invoked and in the penal consequences of offending him, either in this or a future world or both, he will be under the same restraint from perjury as if he had previously subscribed a test requiring this belief. If the person in question be an unbeliever in these points and would, notwithstanding, take the oath, a previous test could have no effect. He would subscribe it as he would take the oath, without any principle that could be affected by either." Madison's argument, expressed by others as well, was that a religious believer would take an oath seriously without need of a religious test, and that a religious test could be declared by an unprincipled atheist without fear of punishment after death. Either way, a religious test was unnecessary. Now, when I placed my hand on the Holy Bible and swore to perform all the duties incumbent upon me as a United States Circuit Judge under the Constitution and laws of the United States, and swore that I would well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which I'm about to enter, so help me God, my conscience was and remains affected by my religious beliefs. Were it not so, what would be the point of placing my hand on the Bible or ending the oath with the declaration, so help me God? Taking a false oath is a violation of the second commandment, not to take the name of the Lord in vain. As the Catechism of the Catholic Church explains, taking an oath or swearing is to take God as witness to what one affirms. It is to invoke the divine truthfulness as a pledge of one's own truthfulness. An oath engages the Lord's name. My entire understanding of my judicial duty flows from taking my oath seriously. James Madison and the other framers of the Constitution expected nothing less. My religious faith also informs my perspective on my judicial duty to obey lawful authority. I believe I have a moral obligation to obey our government and its laws. Before I became a judge, this perspective informed my decision as the Attorney General of Alabama to obey the federal injunction that required the removal of a monument of the Ten Commandments in the state judicial building. My moral duty to obey the law pertains to my judicial duty now, just as it pertained to my executive duty then. My faith informs my judicial duty in a third way, by inculcating me with a belief in the moral duty to work. I believe that work is, in a real sense, a form of prayer. This religious belief motivates my commitment to my oath to well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office of a circuit judge. The final way my faith informs my performance as a judge is by teaching me to be honest. The moral duty of honesty requires both truthfulness in communication and reasoning and respect for the property of others. This duty is reflected in the commandments against bearing false witness and stealing, respectively. Regarding the former, The Catechism has the following strong words about the necessity for truth in a judicial system. When it is made publicly, a statement contrary to the truth takes on particular gravity. In court, it becomes false witness. When it is under oath, it is perjury. Acts such as these contribute to condemnation of the innocent, exoneration of the guilty, or the increased punishment of the accused. They gravely compromise the exercise of justice and the fairness of judicial decisions. Although my faith properly informs and motivates me to be faithful to my oath of office and to my moral duties to obey the government and its laws and to work both diligently and honestly, there is a limit to the relevance of religion in the performance of my judicial duty. That limit is defined by the very nature of my judicial authority. Properly understood, the exercise of my authority as a federal judge is governed by the law, and that understanding is where the real controversy exists in the contemporary debate about judicial authority. As a judge, I'm not given the authority to use a personal moral perspective to update or alter the text of our Constitution and laws. The business of using moral judgment to change the law is reserved to the political branches, which is why the officers of those branches are regularly elected by the people. A judge's task is limited to serving as an umpire, so that controversies between citizens and officers of their government may be resolved based on the law. For that limited task, a federal judge is granted a privilege designed to secure his independence: life tenure with no reduction in salary. Except by inflation. An officer of a political branch, such as Congress, is free to propose changes in the law that conform with his perspective of morality, as informed by his religion. For centuries, members of Congress have supported a wide variety of laws on this kind of basis, whether to abolish slavery, withdraw troops from foreign wars, abolish child labor, guarantee civil rights, provide assistance to the poor and sick, protect marriage, or prohibit the sale of intoxicating liquors. The changing of laws enacted by political authorities is not a judge's task. The duty of the judge is the application of those laws in controversies within the jurisdiction of the courts. I do not mean to suggest that the task of judging is either mechanical or easy. The meaning and application of the law is sometimes difficult to discern, which is why judges in good faith sometimes disagree. The duty to administer justice requires the exercise of judgment, but not the employment of religious doctrine as a source of authority to supplant or evade the law when judging becomes difficult or its outcome undesirable. A judge who is motivated by moral duties to fulfill his oath and obey the law must strive to be as objective as possible, using traditional methods of construction, reliance on precedent, and legal reasoning. This limited understanding of the judicial role has served our nation well for more than two centuries. It has allowed our judiciary as a separate branch to perform, when necessary, its vital role of demanding compliance with the Constitution. In short, the rule of law that flows from the separation of powers has preserved our freedom. With that understanding of my moral and legal duties in mind, allow me to return to my experience as the Attorney General of Alabama to illustrate how my understanding guided me. In the days following the removal of his monument of the Ten Commandments, Chief Justice Roy Moore and his prominent supporters advanced three arguments against those of us who complied with the federal injunction. They argued, first, that we had a moral duty to acknowledge God that required us to disobey the injunction. Second, as they surrounded the state judicial building in hopes of preventing the removal of the monument, Moore's prominent supporters compared their struggle with that of the civil rights movement led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. In turn, they compared those of us who complied with the federal injunction with the defenders of racial segregation. Finally, Moore argued that we had a duty to disobey the injunction as we would, he argued, if the injunction had allowed slavery. I disagreed with Moore. I agreed that I had a moral duty. I argued that I had a moral duty as a Christian to obey the federal injunction. There was no moral justification for civil disobedience. My oath to uphold the Constitution required me, as Attorney General, to obey the injunction without regard to whether I agreed with the basis for that injunction. My moral duty was not in conflict or even tension with my legal duty. My Christian duty instead provided the foundation for my public duty. I explained that the Christian duty to obey the government and its laws is clearly expressed in the New Testament. In St. Matthew's Gospel, Jesus gave a provocative lesson about the moral duty to obey the government. Repay to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and to God what belongs to God. In his epistle to the Romans, the Apostle Paul taught, let every person be subordinate to higher authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been established by God. And in his first epistle, Peter wrote, be subject to every human institution for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the approval of those who do good. During the several years that I served as Attorney General, I defended the constitutionality of depicting the Ten Commandments in a courthouse. I assisted the governor in creating a display of several foundations of our law, including the Ten Commandments, in the old Supreme Court library of our state capitol. I publicly agreed with the opinion written by the late Chief Justice Rehnquist that the Ten Commandments, quote, have made a substantial contribution to our secular legal codes. Nevertheless, in the controversy about Roy Moore, I was obliged, morally and legally, to obey the injunction of the federal court. Removing the monument of the Ten Commandments from the building of the government did not require me or another official to violate a moral duty. Christ did not command anyone to maintain a monument of the Ten Commandments in the rotunda of a courthouse. The legality of a monument in the rotunda of Caesar's courthouse is a question for Caesar. What about the second accusation? Did compliance with the injunction violate the civil rights of Christians? Were the protesters outside the state judicial building engaged in rightful civil disobedience? Was Chief Justice Moore the new Dr. King, and I the modern-day Bull Connor? The answer to all these questions is no. The authoritative text on this issue, I submit, is the letter written by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. from the Birmingham City Jail on Easter weekend, 1963. The letter was addressed to liberal white clergy of Birmingham who opposed segregation but did not support King's nonviolent protest against racial discrimination. The white religious leaders argued that as a Christian, King had a duty to obey the government. King responded that he was not obliged to obey an immoral or unjust law. King argued, based on the writings of St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, that an unjust law is a human law that is not rooted in eternal and natural law. King contended that segregation statutes are unjust because segregation distorts the soul and damages the personality. He explained, a law is unjust if it is inflicted on a minority that, as a result of being denied the right to vote, had no part in enacting or devising the law. He concluded that a law is unjust when it is used to deny citizens the First Amendment privilege of peaceful assembly and protest. King's case was that segregation treated black persons as less than citizens and gave them no political recourse to remedy their injury. Then King explained the difference between unjust defiance and just civil disobedience. He wrote, in no sense do I advocate evading or defying the law, as would the rabid segregationists. That would lead to anarchy. One who breaks an unjust law must do so openly, lovingly, and with a willingness to accept the penalty. I submit that an individual who breaks a law that conscience tells him is unjust and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the conscience of the community over its injustice is in reality expressing the highest respect for law. Dr. King's letter belies any comparison of the civil rights protest of 1963 in Birmingham and the protests of Roy Moore and his supporters in 2003 in Montgomery. The injunction to remove the monument did not distort the soul or personality of Christians, because Christianity is not dependent upon the presence of a monument in a government building. The injunction did not represent a government denial of political recourse for Christians. Christians still enjoy the constitutional rights to vote, hold office, speak, exercise our faith, and assemble. Indeed, the election of Roy Moore and the peaceful protest for 2 weeks outside the state judicial building, complete with extensive freedom of the press, illustrated the vitality of the civil rights of Christians. The most fundamental distinction between Dr. King's example and Roy Moore's example is the difference between defiance of the law and civil disobedience. Dr. King expected the law he called unjust to be enforced against him. But Roy Moore and his supporters said they expected our state officials not to enforce the injunction. Dr. King was a private citizen who, in his words, lovingly accepted the punishment of an unjust law. But Roy Moore was a public official who refused to obey and sought to evade any punishment or responsibility. A private citizen may, in extreme circumstances, engage in civil disobedience by accepting the punishment of an unjust law. But a public official has no such option. A public official is sworn to uphold the law. Perhaps the greatest irony was the reaction of Roy Moore's supporters following the removal of the monument from the rotunda. When we complied with the injunction, the supporters of Moore called on me to resign. As a public official, if I'm ever unable to fulfill my oath and obey the law, then I should resign. The duty of a public official brings me to my response to Roy Moore's final contention, that we were obliged to disobey the injunction as he argued we would disobey an order allowing slavery. After the associate justices unanimously ordered the building manager to comply with the injunction, Roy Moore said, "If the rule of law means to do everything a judge tells you to do, we would still have slavery in this country." Now, this assertion is contrary to the American history of the abolition of slavery, especially the example set by the great emancipator, Abraham Lincoln. An infamous decision of the Supreme Court, of course, promoted slavery. In 1857, the Supreme Court ruled in Dred Scott that the Missouri Compromise, which prohibited slavery in Western territories, was unconstitutional and that blacks were not citizens. Abraham Lincoln argued that Dred Scott was wrongly decided and must be opposed. But Lincoln's perspective about the proper response to Dred Scott is instructive. In October 1858, Lincoln explained in one of his famous debates with Stephen Douglas as follows: "We oppose the Dred Scott decision in a certain way. We do not propose that when Dred Scott has been decided to be a slave by the court, we as a mob will decide him to be free. We do not propose that when any one or 1,000 shall be decided by that court to be slaves, we will in any violent way disturb the rights of property thus settled. But we nevertheless do oppose that decision as a political rule which shall be binding on the voter to vote for nobody who thinks it wrong, which shall be binding on the members of Congress or the president to favor no measure that does not actually concur with the principles of that decision. We propose so resisting it as to have it reversed if we can, and a new judicial rule established on this subject." Lincoln explained that there were two ways of opposing a decision of a court allowing slavery. One method of opposition was illegitimate and to be avoided. The other method of opposition was legitimate and necessary. The illegitimate opposition was defiance of a final order of a court. Lincoln recognized that the Constitution in Article III created a federal judiciary to resolve disputes, particularly involving the interpretation of the Constitution. Upon the resolution of their disputes, the parties to the lawsuit, in Lincoln's view, were obliged to follow the orders of the court, and non-parties were obliged to respect the resolution of that dispute between the parties. Public officials sworn to uphold this constitutional framework for resolving disputes were obliged to enforce the final orders of this process as between the parties, without regard to the public officials' opinions of the correctness of the ruling. The legitimate method of opposition, according to Lincoln, was political. Voters should support candidates who would work to end slavery, elected representatives should enact laws to end slavery, and the judiciary should, in proper cases, reverse its erroneous decisions that promoted slavery. Lincoln also supported another, more provocative method of opposition. Lincoln refused to allow the Dred Scott decision to bind his administration. Lincoln required his administration, for example, to issue a passport to a black student and a patent to a black inventor. Lincoln supported policies of the government that challenged the continued application of Dred Scott because Lincoln considered those policies constitutional, notwithstanding the erroneous precedent in Dred Scott. As Lincoln explained in his inaugural address, the candid citizen must confess that if the policy of the government upon vital questions affecting the whole people is to be irrevocably fixed by decisions of the Supreme Court, the instant they are made in ordinary litigation between parties, in personal actions, the people will have ceased to be their own rulers, having, to that extent, practically resigned their government into the hands of that eminent tribunal. When the judiciary interprets the Constitution erroneously, the American people still retain all the lawful tools of political opposition that President Lincoln employed. The American people can campaign for different policies. The American people can elect candidates who will enact their favorite policies. Elected officials can appoint judges faithful to the rule of law. The American people can bring new cases before the courts and urge the overruling of erroneous precedents. If necessary, the American people can even amend the Constitution. But defiance of the law is not a remedy under the Constitution. Contrary to Roy Moore's argument, slavery did not end through the defiance of an injunction by a public official. Slavery was abolished following our bloody Civil War with the adoption of the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. The rebellion of the Southern states set the wrong example of defiance. Many might say, and I would agree, that it's easy to see why Roy Moore was wrong to take the law into his own hands. Because our liberty depends on the rule of law, we're all bound to obey, even when we disagree with the decisions of our courts. As St. Thomas More said, "The law, Roper, the law. I know what's legal, not what's right, and I'll stick to what's legal." But the controversy about Roy Moore raises another question. What about those who applaud or publish glowing editorials when other judges place their own different notions of morality above the law? That wrong can be done from either the right, as in the case of Roy Moore, or the left. The law is not a mirror that will always reflect our individual notions of right and wrong. For courts, questions about morality, including the death penalty, marriage, and family, for example, are to be resolved based on the law, not based on what a majority of lawyers or judges think the law should be. Legislators and voters may change the law and be formed by morality in that endeavor, but none of us has the authority to defy or subvert the law in the name of morality. Faced with a conflict of law and morality, we should follow the example of St. Thomas More, who resigned as Lord Chancellor after King Henry VIII left his wife Catherine for relations with Anne Boleyn, and the clergy surrendered the property of the church in England to the king. When the English Parliament passed the Act of Succession, which made Anne Boleyn's issue first in succession to the crown, St. Thomas More said he would swear to the succession, for it was the law of the land. but he refused to declare the supremacy of the king over the church. St. Thomas More recognized clearly his duty to render to God what belongs to him while rendering to Caesar what belongs to him. In his devotion to duty, St. Thomas More paid the ultimate price. As More succinctly explained a moment before his execution, he died the king's good servant and God's first. St. Thomas More lovingly accepted the punishment of an unjust law, like Dr. King did centuries later in America. Both St. Thomas More and Dr. King rejected the path of defiance and evasion and a subversion of the law. They recognized that path would lead, in Dr. King's words, to anarchy, when moral duty instead required the highest respect for the law. Those who would, like William Roper or Roy Moore, cut down the law to get after the devil, risk falling into his trap. When the devil turns round, where will they hide? The laws all being flat. For me, I will strive to follow St. Thomas More's example and give even the devil the benefit of law for my own safety's sake. Thank you. From their perspective, we had a tyrannical government that had lost its authority, and it was violating their fundamental civil liberties, and they pledged their sacred honor to each other and risked their very lives for the defense of their liberties. They were perfectly willing to accept the penalties that were coming to them for the defense of their freedom, right? That's different from a public official defying the law. If you're a public official, if they were royal officials and they felt that the government was tyrannical, it was their obligation to leave that government, right, and defend their liberty and to support the American Revolution, an extreme circumstance. But it would have been inappropriate for them to remain as part of that government and to be lying as part of their oath and loyalty to that government while supporting the revolution. They had to choose. They chose.
What about the theory that times in the past, I think of the time of the American Revolution, that a lower sovereign authority
that each has its own sovereignty. Well, I'm not exactly sure what you're referring to. Our own government established a government of dual sovereignty. But it also did so under a constitution that established itself as the supreme law of the land, right? That governs both of the sovereigns. And at the end of the day, we're bound by that constitution. I'm not here to say that we live in a time where we won't face moral conflicts with our government or with our law. I'm not here to say either that some judges might not have to face moral conflicts in the performance of their duties. I think that there are occasions when judges may face that now. I think that a Catholic judge, for example, at a state court, who has the responsibility for determining whether a minor should have permission to have an abortion, has a real moral question that in some circumstance may require the resignation of that official or the recusal of that official, lest they be involved in the material proximate cooperation with evil that would make them responsible for sinful behavior. Those kinds of questions can arise, and I recognize too that we may be living in times where we're going to have more of those kinds of tough questions face us all. But we've got to be wide open, open-eyed about our moral responsibilities, our responsibilities to God and to the government in the way that St. Thomas More was. When the Acts of Supremacy and the Act of Succession were passed, St. Thomas More worked very hard. He wanted to read the actual acts. He wanted to read the actual oaths. He wanted to take the oaths if he could. He recognized that he had a duty to obey the government if he could. That's what he wanted to do. That's why he was willing to swear to the Act of Succession. He could do that without violating a moral duty. The Act of Supremacy posed a conflict that could not be resolved.
Thank you very much for clarifying so many complicated things. I know it's dangerous in warfare, hypotheticals in the tower, right? But let me put you a middle case. Leaving aside Roy Moore's unfortunate surname, what if he had resigned?
Yeah, oh, that would have been a different situation.
And then called upon you to resign as well. And I guess maybe rephrase that, okay. Rephrase that question again. What role is there in protesting imprudence on the part of Caesar? And does the oath bind you to ignore those kinds of questions? Does the oath protect you from that sort of concern?
Well, I would not have had any moral duty to resign. Had he resigned, I don't think that, first of all, that there would have been any occasion for me to be worried about enforcing any order, because the associate justices of our state Supreme Court were unanimous in their desire to comply with the injunction, and my role would not have been necessary. Had he called on me to resign, though, I would have said, I'm sorry, but I don't think that a granite 2-ton monument that you constructed of the Ten Commandments that has copyright Roy Moore on the bottom of it, that's a true story, is something that's worth me resigning my public office over. I campaigned for this office. There are responsibilities to the people of Alabama and to the Constitution of the United States that I take seriously, and I don't think that decoration and the rotunda of the Alabama Judicial Building is the sort of thing that that would cause me to want to resign.
Bill, thoughtful as ever, and you may know we've been having a seminar that brings together some gifted teachers with some stars of the federal bench, including your friends. I was a bit before you, the musing of one of your friends. I was looking at Judge Conway's decision in the question with abortion, federal bill in New York. And he went into explicit, gory detail about the grisly nature of that procedure. But by the end, of course, he felt obliged to strike down that law because he had to honor Stemler versus Carhart. But he had to strike it down because there was no health, exception for health, when it was not even clear that that procedure was necessary for the health of the mother. So the question before our friend was, why couldn't this judge turn and say, the court never took evidence about the nature of the child, the fetus in the womb. Is this really what you meant to install? And especially when there's not even clear that the health exception is relevant. So could Judge Casey, what might prevent Judge Casey from saying, I'll send this one up, and I'm going to take a sort of second look. And of course, he would have been sustained, because that was the position that the court, now adding Sam Alito and John Roberts, did take. It would have sustained him. It's not a question of what might prevent you from doing what people on the left often do, just take a flyer, challenge them. And what might it constrain you from doing that?
Well, if there's a material difference, unaccounted for in precedent, that the inferior court judge thinks should be considered, and means that the precedent does not bind him to reach the decision that one side might argue that the precedent requires, then the judge can make. Can make that ruling. If the judge is bound by the precedent, then it'll be up to the superior court to overrule its precedent, which effectively the Supreme Court did in that area. Yes.
I had a real quick question just about short of current event, not being an attorney or anything like that. Like separation of power. So Trump put in this little thing, and then the judge told him, you know, you can't do that. But as the President of the United States, of separation of power from the judiciary and Congress, couldn't he have gone ahead with what he was doing without actually violating?
I can't talk about pending cases. That is one thing. Federal judges, there are lots of cases that involve the current administration that are pending in the courts, and federal judges cannot publicly speak about pending litigation. Canons of...
It just kind of...
I understand it. I understand your perspective, but under the canons, I can't talk about it.
I understand your perspective.
My duty.
Moral.
Well, this is actually legal duty. And moral duty.
George Perry, thank you for the talk. As you know, despite the witness of Thomas More and John Fisher, for centuries, England banned Catholics from holding public office and still bans them from certain offices. And so I think the concern is there's the particular issues that you're addressing, but I think a lot of people have these sort of broader concerns. There's a lot of debate about Kim Daniels' decision to not grant marriage license to a same-sex couple. So I think the sort of broader question is, are we really facing a situation where in a few decades Catholics and Christians simply can't hold public office because of
I hope not.
Fidelity?
I do think that that we owe our first duty to God. And happily, for most of the history of our country, we could perform our religious duties, our moral duties, without fear of conflict with legal duties. But I do not suggest that it will always be this way. And it may be that there will be times when we have to make more difficult choices. I think Justice Alito has said something pretty similarly recently. We've had it good, we Catholics. This has been a good country to us. We have a responsibility for taking our witness for the gospel to the people of the United States and explaining the truth of the gospel. And at the end of the day, that brings us in conflict with the law. We have to live by the truth of the gospel. Yes, sir.
So I'm curious. When you define it very clearly as I'm the umpire, I'm a judge, and therefore just an umpire of the law, I don't actually get to infuse my own belief into the law, it makes complete sense. And I think you gave a...
I can't use religion to supplant the law.
your presentation was more clarifying than any other presentation on this talk I've ever heard, actually, so thank you so much. But I think that it gave such clarity that I didn't realize why there's this instinct to disagree as well at the same time. And that instinct is that there's actually something else that you've been elected to, it seems to me, which is you're not just a judge, you're also a public leader. And so I guess the question is, and the gentleman's question earlier kind of alluded to this, is there a middle ground where you would not resign but continue in protest? Or that, is there a middle ground where you would not resign but leverage your role as a public leader, not just a judge, and continue in protest?
That's a difficult question. So let's say that there's that I face a conflict of moral and legal duty as a judge. But it's an isolated instance, okay? Participation in a particular case and enforcing the government's mandate in some fashion would be sinful. And my endorsement of it by ruling that way and consistent with the law would, in my view, be proximate material cooperation with evil, would be sinful in and of itself. If it's an isolated instance, I think one thing that the public leader, that you're avoiding scandal is part of the equation for any Catholic as they contemplate cooperation with evil. You know, it may be that in some cases a judge enforces the law in a way that allows third parties to do immoral acts. Okay? Let me use an example that's not from law. The mailman. The mailman delivers holy Bibles, life-saving medications, and pornography. Now, we recognize that the mailman has a responsibility under the law to respect the rules for prompt delivery of everything where postage has been paid, even though the delivery of some of those articles is evil. But by doing his duty with respect to all the articles and not looking behind that responsibility, he won't be confused as having endorsed the material that he delivers. He will not have proximately and materially cooperated or with evil in a way that would make his conduct sinful. He doesn't have the kind of public leader role where he has to worry about avoiding scandal and leading others into error. A judge would, for example, enforce First Amendment jurisprudence that would allow an adult bookstore to operate. Does that mean that the judge has endorsed that activity, has engaged in scandal, has violated his public leader role from a moral perspective? No. But it may be, in the example that I gave earlier about the minor who wants permission to have an abortion, that the cooperation with evil there is far more proximate, and therefore the scandal, potential scandal, is far greater, and the judge would have a responsibility to recuse. Now, if that kind of duty, if that kind of real conflict where the judge has to worry about engaging in something that would be a sin in itself by that judicial ruling, if that arises so frequently, then I think the judge would have a responsibility of stepping aside and resigning. I don't think that a Catholic judge could have served as a judge in Nazi Germany, for example, or that you could serve as one in Communist China, in all probability. So, you know, that's a tough question.
One last question, brief question.
Just wanted a
lot of your defense of the Roy Moore decision is kind of based on deference to the system. I was wondering if you could comment on what a lot of conservatives believe about the idea that the federal court system has become tyrannical, you know, a Ho Chi Minh Trail of democracy. I was wondering if you could kind of comment on that.
I'm a federal judge. I'm sorry, I'm not part of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Look, the Supreme Court has made grave errors throughout its history. That's not new. Dred Scott was a long time ago. Plessy was a long time ago. There have been a lot of others. Buck v. Bell was a long time ago. All wrong, all morally indefensible, but we nevertheless have enjoyed the freedom of our Constitution in a way that I would say, on balance, has made public officials, Catholics in particular, entering the public square and participating in our constitutional government worthwhile. I haven't reached that point.
Thank you.
Thank you.